everyone. We are starting a new group now. So this is sort of the sequel to the Merleau-Ponty group, which itself was the sequel to the Simondon group. The reading that we're going to be embarking on is Raymond Ruyer. I keep forgetting the actual title of the text, but it's the book about cybernetics, which appeared in English translation at the end of last year in December 2023. But as the sort of intro to that text, we are reading an article by N. Catherine Hales. The title of the article is Boundary Disputes, Homeostasis, Reflexivity, and the Foundations of Cybernetics. So this text, if I am not mistaken, was published in two different places. There was like a journal article version, and then it was included an edited collection. So the version that I posted on the Discord server that we've been using is the one from the edited collection. So the book is, the title of the book is Virtual Reality and Its Discontents. So this PDF is a little bit nicer. There's a PDF of the journal article version that's sort of circulating online, but it's like someone just hit print screen while like looking on whatever academic article portal or whatever. So it had like watermarks and stuff on it. It's not very readable, in my opinion, but I mean, it's fine. You can still, you know, get the content from it, but the version from the book is a little bit nicer to read. I'm not sure if there's any difference in the content. I didn't like compare them line by line or anything. But anyway, so the book version, that book is available on the Internet Archive. You can, I think, like borrow it for an hour at a time and read the article in there. Or there's also on various services that are not to be named in public. There are PDFs of the full book that you can also find. Or if you have access to a university library, they might have the paper copy of the book. So anyway, yeah. So the title of the article is Boundary Disputes, Homeostasis, Reflexivity, and the Foundations of Cybernetics. I didn't mark down what year. It's the early 90s that this was published. So, before we started recording, we were just talking a little bit about how some of the vocabulary and like ideas and so on are pretty dated. They, like, you can tell that this text was from the early 90s, but I think a lot of the arguments and presentation and so on are still very useful for our purposes to give ourselves a sort of introduction to cybernetics before jumping into the Ruyer book. And then also, I think, as like an approach to intellectual history is also pretty helpful as well. I think this is a good like methodology if you want to study like where ideas come from and so on. But we can talk more about that as we proceed. In terms of format, what we normally do with our reading groups that we've done over the last few years is like read through a text, one page at a time and discuss. But in the interest of keeping the discussion of this text to one session, we decided to modify the format. So we ask people to read the text in advance, and then we will be discussing it in a more, I guess, free-form way, so not just sort of going through it page by page. The plan is to go back to that format for the book itself, but for this session, we won't be reading through it page by page. So we'll just be going through like what elements of this text people thought were like interesting or important, or things that people had questions about and so on. Rather than, this linear progression through the text. A couple of things that I'll just get started with a couple of points that stood out to me, and then we can, everyone can add their thoughts and questions and so on. Like I mentioned right at the beginning, this sort of approach to intellectual history, I think, was pretty interesting, and I think was a good way of, like, presenting this sort of, I don't know, intellectual grouping of cybernetics in a more comprehensible way, because cybernetics was such a sort of nebulous enterprise. Like, there were so many different people like who were using this term in as like maybe sort of a marketing term in some sense, I'm cool and sophisticated and doing something high tech, and that's why I'm using the term cybernetics. And it's not there doesn't really seem to be like this one sort of coherent set of principles or like a cybernetic doctrine. You can say everyone who is doing cybernetics, shares this doctrine or something like that. So there's like disagreements about even like the basic ideas, like information, like what does information mean? So it makes it quite confusing to read about cybernetics and try to understand what is going on, because you have two people who are discussing information, but they mean something completely different by it, and it's not always obvious to us as readers, what is it, 70 years later, which meaning of information people are using. And I think sometimes even to them at the time, like the participants, it wasn't always obvious whether they were using the term in the same sense, or they sometimes seem to be talking past each other in confusing ways. So I think this approach to intellectual history that sort of takes apart these ideas and sees how they connect with each other, I think this approach is helpful in especially this sort of confusing intellectual environment so rather than saying here's what information means to cybernetics, which would be like an oversimplification or sort of a selection of one of these meanings over the other, it instead takes the fact that there are these multiple meanings as part of the part of what is to be explained. Like you're trying to present these multiple meanings with each other, in relation to each other, and show how the interaction between these multiple meanings is part of what constitutes cybernetics as a field or as a sort of intellectual grouping. I think this is a very helpful approach, and you could probably take the same approach to other fields that that have a similar sort of nebulous quality or this talking past each other phenomenon and so on. I haven't seen anyone sort of take up this approach, but I think you could use the same kind of approach in history of philosophy, which is also of course full of these instances of people taking a term from someone else but giving it a completely different meaning and so on. I think that was the main thing I took away from this article. And we were reading it primarily for the historical background, but I think the method is actually the most interesting part for me.
Yeah, one thing one aspect of this article that I guess just coming back to information theory, and we had talked about Shannon's conception of information in the UC Mondone reading group. And it seems that, some of the concerns that Simon Don had about, the applicability of, Shannon's notion of information to fields beyond electrical engineering, it was interesting to see that they were kind of there from the beginning. Can't remember the person's first name, but, McKay, and the people who are involved in these conferences who emphasize reflexivity, at least on Hale's reconstruction, sort of seem to be making these, seem to have similar concerns to those Simon Don had about the generation and reception of information, in addition to the just a description of the transmission. Yeah, and then I guess the discussion of these experiments on the frog. I can't remember the guy's name. It's not Varela. What's the other guy?
Maturana.
Yeah, thank you. The idea of this kind of non-causal account of perception kind of helped clarify some of the things we had talked about with Merleau-Ponty, who also rejects this account of causality and the representational, presuppositions of the stimulus response theory of perception.
Yeah, it'd be, I can't remember the exact year of publication of the Guillet book. Let me just think of it. 1954. Yeah, so it would be before the Maturana stuff becomes this autopoiesis and all these concepts start to become established. It would be interesting to sort of read the Guillet book with that in mind, to see what extent his arguments sort of push in that direction, or maybe are not applicable to this third wave cybernetics as Hales describes it. This notion of information, I was definitely thinking also of Simondon as I was reading the discussion of information there. And so yeah, for those who maybe were not around when we were doing the Simondon reading, like what are the sort of key problems that Simondon sees with the like notion of information? So like, so first of all, he recognizes that like this engineering definition of information is very important for like technical purposes, and you know, it helps to sort of clarify the concept of information and so on. But he thinks that it is a kind of secondary phenomenon, or like it's something that you can't sort of extend beyond the boundaries of that like technical usage. And these, one of the examples he gives is like if you have an image that you're trying to transmit electronically, you know, through a cable to a TV, for example, if we're talking about like 1950s technology, you would, and you have the image you want to transmit is a square, just a, you know, I don't know, a black square on a white background. This is a very simple image. You can just specify, you know, the, you know, two of the corners of the square and the color of the interior and exterior. Like, you know, this is a very simple image to transmit, a very low amount of information that you need to transmit in this engineering sense. And then by contrast, if you take a picture of like say like the static you know, the snow pattern on an old TV, if you like took a still image of that and tried to transmit it, that would be a much higher amount of information to transmit. You would have to specify the white or black fill of each like square on the TV screen. But the square is obviously much more like informative in the sort of non-technical sense than just a snow pattern on the screen. Like no one cares really if the, you know, third square in the 10th line is black versus white. It doesn't make a difference to anyone. Whereas, you know, the fact that you're transmitting a square, this is like a geometrical shape that has, I mean, it's not that interesting to see a square, but if, you know, the square versus a triangle versus a circle, et cetera, that could have some sort of significance for a person. Or like the example he gives is like, if you want to take a photograph of sand, just like a you know, a bunch of sand on the beach or whatever, you have to have like a film, like the film that you're using or whatever mechanism you're using to capture that picture has to be fine-grained enough that you can actually like have the location of each grain of sand, you know, be captured and transmitted accurately. But like in terms of the significance, you know, the you know, what it means for someone or what difference it makes to someone who is like seeing this image, the, you know, the fact that there's a grain of sand, you know, in precisely this location and not 1 millimeter to the right is like not significant at all. It doesn't convey any information in a sort of semantic sense. And then the other sort of like paradoxical, yeah, so like the like bigger implication of this is that like the image or the message or whatever it is that you're transmitting, that it's completely sort of arbitrary and meaningless, like the snow pattern on the TV screen or you know, the distribution of grains of sand on the beach or whatever. These messages are they contain a very high amount of information. Whereas something like, you know, a sequence of letters that forms a sentence or the square on the TV screen, these messages that are significant, that contain information in sort of the everyday sense or the semantic sense, have a much lower degree of information in the technical sort of communication engineering sense. And so Simondon takes this to be like sort of a sign that something has gone wrong, or that like the technical sense of information is not really capturing what we mean by information in the more like everyday sense. And specifically the question is like, so in this technical sense of information or this communication engineering discipline, you always take the message to already exist. You say like, here's a message at one location, one part of this technical apparatus, and then we want to transmit it across some, you know, some wires or like through electromagnetic radiation or whatever. And then it gets received somewhere, and you want to figure out, you know, what properties does this medium have to have for the signal to be transmitted accurately? Like, how do you deal with noise in the medium and so on? But like the actual generation of that message in the first place is not something that you account for at all. And so this is what Simondon wants to look at, is like, how does that message get produced in the first place? Like the generation of that message you know, is a kind of like information process. The information has to arise in the first place before it can be transmitted. But that's something that is not explained at all in this information theoretical discipline. So these are sort of like the two major problems that Simondon sees with this technical notion of information when it's used as like a way of explaining or of like accounting for human behavior, human, you know, mental life and so on, in the way that some of these cybernetics people tried to use it.
I have a little bit of a communications background, and it's yeah, for me it was really simple. Information was a kind of a technical problem to solve. So the message would already be given. It's like the cable company would say, "Hey, we will distribute our image. You make sure it gets there." I really like the idea that you kind of build up from the information definition and then slowly add in meaning. But again, I think this text talked about it where it was like the engineers didn't want to get into that McKay definition. They were much more, it was easier to run with the Shannon definition, which was just the simple technical.
Yeah, and I think the like historical context is also helpful here because Shannon was working at Bell Labs. So he's working for a telephone company. And this was like, this is sort of like the equivalent of, you know, you have like companies like Microsoft and Google now have their own like research enterprises. So these are people that their work they're doing is connected to the company's, you know, products and so on. But it's also not like directly tied to like designing a better product or like, you know, making a new product to sell. It's like much more open ended. Bell, AT&T and so on in the 40s and 50s were like sort of the high-tech companies of their time. So they had, you know, the money to dedicate to this kind of open-ended research. But at the same time, it's still connected to like the more like pragmatic sort of everyday concerns of the company. And in the case of a telephone company, one of the sort of key questions is like, what's the minimum amount of cable that we need to lay to be able to transmit all the telephone calls that we are, you know, likely to be presented with in running our telephone service. And so like this account of information has to do with like, if X number of people are speaking over the telephone at a given time, how much cable does it take to, ensure that these telephone communications are, transmitting the person's voice in a way that allows for the receiver to, comprehend, but to accurately detect the message that was being transmitted at the other end. So that's sort of like the economic basis for this whole approach to communication. And so like, you know, whether that telephone communication is like, you know, a life or death decision being conveyed, or if it's just someone like saying what they had for breakfast, it's completely trivial. Like it doesn't matter from the perspective of the engineer. It's just, you know, the sound waves strike the diaphragm in the telephone and get converted into electronic signals that get conveyed through this cable. And then at the other end, it causes the diaphragm to vibrate and produces another sound wave. And, you know, you sort of bracket out any question of like what the person on the speaking end, intended or wanted to convey or whatever. And then what the person on the receiving end, you know, understands, like that is completely irrelevant from your perspective as a communications engineer. You just sort of focus on the what happens in between those steps and ensure that the signal is transmitted without distortion that makes it impossible to like detect what the message was at the originating point. So it's like completely ignoring anything about like the significance of this message, you know, what it might mean to someone, what kinds of effects it might have on the receiver and or what effect it was intended to have and so on. That's just like a purely technical operation, in terms of the functioning of a telephone company. But the sort of intellectual enterprise that was sort of that accompanied this definition was this project to sort of take this very simple and like technical definition of information and try to like build up a more complicated process and say like a living organism, or including human beings, would essentially be like the same kind of information transmission process just like, you know, in a more complicated form or like in more different circumstances and so on. And so like in this article, in the Hales article, she talks about how like a lot of the like sort of models that they used, whether it's like an actual, you know, device that they constructed, like the homeostat and so on, or just a sort of intellectual model, these models were extremely simple. Like a lot of these things are like, you know, like a dozen transistors or like a dozen vacuum tubes or whatever. Like it's like, you know, ludicrously simple when you compare even like insects have like thousands of neurons and humans have billions of neurons. If you're like trying to model a nervous system. So these like devices are like far simpler even than an insect nervous system. And then they were like sort of using the functioning of these devices to like draw conclusions about how human beings make decisions or like the formation of a neurosis in a human being or and so on, like these kinds of very speculative conclusions that were drawn from these extremely simplified models. So that's like the like broader intellectual project that sort of extends this technical definition of information to like explain the nature of human existence as a whole in this very speculative way.
And to that point, I want to stress that how I kind of read the Macy conferences, and this fascinates me. It almost to me seems like a bunch of electrical engineers and highly technical people came into the field of psychology and said, hey, we got it from here. And what we get is an interesting critique of behaviorism. And to me, this is what strikes the cognitive revolution.
Yeah, and yeah, so yeah, that's the guy's name is Kubi. And actually he's Simondon cites him in one of the, I think it was in the Imagination Information book. He cites one of his contributions to the Macy conference. Yeah, so he like comes in and keeps saying like this is like he keeps telling the people like you're like oversimplifying everything. You're, like the fact that you're trying to consider a human being as like the same type of device as like this robot made of like six vacuum tubes is like kind of absurd. And everyone is like extremely angry at him. They like don't want to hear this message. So it's pretty funny that it's the psychologist who has to like explain to these electrical engineers that like actually a human being is a little bit more complicated than a telephone.
Maybe that was their pride and hubris they had kind of gotten from the post-war hype.
Yeah, to Bat's point here in the chat, I think Hale says that Kubi is actually the one who has the most contribution, like the highest proportion of the total of the Macy conference transcripts is actually Kubi's contributions. Like he's the individual person who has the highest highest proportion of the total transcripts, which is kind of funny because he was like the one who was telling everyone that like your ideas don't actually work.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised to see that it was Shannon himself who at the outset was saying he didn't really see that close a connection between his information in the sense in which he had formalized the concept for electrical engineering and what the other thinkers were trying to do at the Macy conferences. And then he has this notion of subjective probability, which Hales doesn't really talk about. But at least part of the purpose of which seems to be just to distinguish information in the engineering sense from information in a broader human sense.
Yeah, I think for a lot of these people, like subjective was sort of like the black box of like the stuff that we don't understand or can't manage. It's like, oh, that's just subjective, so we don't actually need to, account for it. So Shannon was, I think, unlike some of the other people, he was very clear about the fact that what he was doing with this term information or like his concept of information that he was operating with was definitely not the same as the sort of everyday sense of information or this semantic information. And so he says, I'm just defining this term, like I'm taking this word information, I give it this technical definition and I'm using this technical definition and that's all I'm doing. I'm not like telling you anything about what, information in the semantic sense means or whether these messages are significant in like a sense that goes beyond the transmission of information or whatever. I'm just trying to account for like what is required to transmit this message accurately. That's like my whole project. And yeah, like, so there's this other collection of, I think it was like 1960, around there. So it's this conference. So there's the Royaumont series of conferences in France, and Simon Don was involved in organizing this conference on the concept of information that Norbert Wiener attended, and I think some other people who were like some like cybernetics people. And yeah, so I've read a couple of the contributions in that volume, and like the discussion portion afterwards, it, like for each one is like, what does this notion of information have to do with the technical concept of information? Like everyone's just like, every, like you have the person like gives this sort of presentation about this notion of information in relation to like history or literature or whatever. And then someone objects like, this has nothing to do with like Shannon's concept of information. So why are you using the word information? And that's like sort of repeated for each of the contributions. And so like, yeah, so Hales mentioned there's a sort of like tension between the desire to like have this very technical sense of information that you can quantify and like manage in this technical way, and then there's this desire to like, you know, extend the I guess lessons that you take from this technical version of information to you know, understand the nature of human existence, like to get like the broadest possible implications from this notion of information. And and like these two desires are sort of conflicting, because all the things that allow you to extend the notion of information to other domains are precisely the, like, you know, supposed subjective things that that make the notion unmanageable and unquantifiable. So yeah, these like opposing objectives kind of conflict with each other throughout the whole, you know, period of the cybernetic intellectual sphere.
Yeah, I find it really interesting that intuitively, what we call information, at least in like everyday ordinary language, is obviously related to like something being relevant or meaningful, right? And yet this is a completely different approach to the more mathematical, formal concept that Shannon was working with. It's kind of interesting because to me it's like it's a question that appears really early on, right? On one hand, you have this idea that you can model the behaviors of organisms or even humans through this mathematical concept of, you know, input-output machines that process information. And yet, you mentioned it a bit earlier that you can have the question of how do you, I think when you were talking about Simon Don, right, that how do you choose which message to send? That question is kind of outside of the scope of the mathematical modeling that they are doing, and it's such a like fundamental difference between what I would expect, you know, an explanation of the behavior versus the way that they took. That I find that really interesting. Like, I can't help but wonder, like, what exactly was it that they were explaining through this modeling, right? Where are those limits? I think in the Dupuy book, another mathematical advancement that he mentions that was kind of significant for the cybernetics, at the very least at the very beginning, was the Turing machine. And I guess this kind of, if Shannon's conception of information in a mathematical sense gave a strict formal definition of information that they could work with in a rigorous manner, the Turing machine kind of did the same to the mathematical conception of machines, right? There is a sense in which these Turing machines can be the input for another bigger Turing machine and the output and so on, right? So I think Dupuy kind of points at this aspect of it, that it all converges, right? The instructions for the machine are themselves part of the same data that the machine will, or it's the same type of data that the machine will interact with and so on, that you can kind of, or I think Dupuy mentions that they sort of took that as a way of seeing some potential for the modeling of behavior in these terms, since even if we can only describe a specific machine that does a specific thing, because of this conception of machines that is kind of allows a certain second order, you know, referentiality to other machines, it is possible to conceive of a bigger machine that will have as its output, you know, maybe selecting certain behavior from the input of the environment or something like that, right? So I think maybe there's a bit of an implicit appeal. I'm not sure if I'm explaining myself right, but my point is that inside of the cybernetics, the models that we see in this essay that we have read, the Haley's one, are modeling in kind of simple behavior, right? Like the rat maze or the homeostasis machine. There is this sort of vague idea that there could be a higher level in which a machine would govern these smaller machines and so on, right? But I find it kind of interesting that, well, I guess that this is such a like bottoms-up approach to explaining behavior that is just really surprising to me. That it feels to me that focusing on such a low level and maybe leaving the question of how does this relate to behavior with a capital B as a whole for later is like what you end up producing is just radically different, at least to what I would expect. I'm not sure if I made sense. I'm sorry. It's kind of difficult to talk about this.
Yeah, I think in general, there's like this. I don't think they really like were aware of their, I guess, presupposition. But the whole presupposition was that you can start from something like this, yeah, electronic rat, this, you know, maze navigating device, which again is extremely simple, or the, you know, the homeostat and so on. You take these extremely simple devices and basically just make them more complicated and arrive at like a reproduction of human behavior or like the capacities of a human being, you know, just by, you know, taking this very simple device and, you know, making it a bit more complicated. It's interesting to see that like a lot of the, you know, in their sort of attempts to make behavior or, you know, functioning of a machine manageable, they have to sort of discard all these things as, you know, subjective and, you know, not, you know, important and so on. But the whole ambition is supposedly to, like, you know, reproduce or to capture human behavior. So, like, all those things that they had discarded, at some point they have to be able to, like, you know, bring that back in. But, like, they, the only sort of strategy they would have to be able to do that is, like, to take your, like, you know, electronic rat that navigates a maze, and, you know, if you just make it a little bit more complicated, eventually it would like start producing Shakespeare plays or whatever, which is, you know, not that plausible. So like all the subjective stuff that they try to discard is precisely the kinds of things that they like eventually have to be able to account for if they want this sort of mode of explanation to actually sort of be sufficient to account for human behavior as a whole.
Yeah, some of the stuff about animal experiments, I mentioned this earlier, but interesting in, with respect to Merleau-Ponty. In, you know, when we're reading Structure of Behavior, and when he first made that point about this gap between the perceived world and the real world, I think we mentioned as a group that he didn't really spell out some of the implications of, or some of the consequences of that. I think he does by the end of the book, but some of the epistemological consequences, but it seems like Barella and Maturana are pretty straightforward about how, you know, the fact that a frog's eye sees small moving things and sort of ignores larger, slower moving things kind of necessarily means that, you know, the frog is not just like reading off the texture of the real, so to speak, and that something similar must be the case for the experimenter as well. I thought that was interesting. And then the comparing this Shannon's electric rat to the rats that the experiments with rats and mazes that Merleau-Ponty discussed, where, you know, Merleau-Ponty argues that the rat's experience of the maze or the significance of the maze for a rat has this kind of melodic structure, so that when the rat takes the right path and gets to its goal, this sort of retroactively colors its entire experience of the maze so that it can find its way back in a way that is completely different from, a machine which can, I'm not sure exactly how you would program it to remember the turns and the, you know, moves forward and back that it took, but it seems obvious that it wouldn't have the same significant melodic structure that the maze has for the rat in Merleau-Ponty's account.
Yeah, so like, not the rat, I think it was a cat that Simon Don had described, but like the fact that the cat could navigate a maze that that was a sort of spiral pattern moving inwards towards the reward, but the same maze in the opposite direction, like where the cat had to spiral outwards to get the reward, was not able, like the cat couldn't solve this problem because it had to like get further and further away from the reward with each turn of the spiral to actually, you know, finally reach the reward. And so like the fact that the cat is there were other ones we're talking about rats as well, but that's the one I'm thinking of now. The significance of, you know, getting closer or further away from the reward is part of how the cat navigates its maze, and like the capacity that the cat has to do this maze navigation operation is, you know, in part like constituted by the significance of, you know, the approaching or getting further away from a reward. Whereas this, of course, this electronic rat doesn't care if it's getting further or closer to the reward with each turn or with each, you know, step in this maze navigation program. There's no significance of the reward or the, you know, reaching this final position for the electronic rat. It's like taking this extremely simple device that, you know, can find the place where you've inserted the jack in this display grid, and sort of extrapolating from this very simple device and saying this is how, you know, animals that have this much more sophisticated and subtle and complicated maze navigation or generally, you know, just capacity to learn the layout of an environment, and saying this is like just a bit more complicated version of this electronic rat device.
Yeah, I think Bats mentioned something similar earlier too, but this this tension that that Hales talks about between, on the one hand, you know, having these extremely broad ambitions for a unified, you know, theory of information and the ability to explain everything from using the way that information is transmitted along in the use of like a telephone to the development of neurosis. But at the same time, you know, this practical need to simplify and also a hostility to the being reminded that, you know, if you really simplify, then you can't make these extremely generalizing claims, but kind of wanting to have both the simplification that could be modeled and the right to extrapolate that into kind of theory of everything. It's funny and interesting.
Yeah, I think there's also like maybe along the same lines, like in connection with Simon Don, like so in the first sort of wave that Hales described here is this sort of the central concept is this one of homeostasis, right? Like a living being is essentially a machine that tries to maintain a certain state as much as possible. So Simon Don talks about like how living beings are actually metastable as opposed to stable, entities that like, so as a, you know, a rat that, you know, navigates its environment and, you know, seeks out food and so on, this rat is not like, if a living being is in a completely stable state, that means it's not actually capable of undergoing any further change. And that means it's dead, right? So if you define a living being as like, a device that tries to maintain a stable state, you're essentially, you can bring this back to Freud in the death drive. You're saying a living being is essentially an entity that tries to die. But like, yeah, so a living being, and Simon talks about like how, living beings have a certain, like, maybe reservoir of potentials, or, like, you know, capacity to, you know, learn new behaviors or to adapt to new environments and so on. But, like, each time that it exercises that capacity, it sort of uses up some of that reservoir, and eventually it's gone. Like, that's, you know, the end of the life of that organism. And so it's again, this kind of paradoxical enterprise that these cybernetics people are trying to do, where, like, you're trying to explain the capacity of a living being to, like, maintain itself in existence in terms of its actual, like, you know, progression towards death. Like, you know, the life of a living being is actually its, you know, descent into death. And so there's, like, a sign, I think, that something has gone wrong here, that, like, and it's not, and the other thing I would want to sort of specify is that, of course, that homeostasis is a very important component of, you know, what it is for a living being to be alive, that, like, living beings maintain a certain temperature range despite the variations in the environment. They maintain, like, concentrations of certain chemicals inside a membrane versus outside the membrane, and so on. Like, all these things are important and essential to ensuring that the being can stay alive. But to say that, like, life as such is homeostasis is to define life as death, essentially.
Yeah, there's that that great passage in Simondon where he talks about how Aristotle was wrong to say that the slave is a speaking tool, because the slave is capable of deciding not to work, basically, which is, I think, it's one of, I think it's a critique of cybernetics that Simondon makes a couple of times, that, you know, the human being is not a homeostat, as you were just saying, and is capable of setting novel directions for itself. I think that point in Simondon is relevant to this kind of struggle between the homeostatic and reflexive tendencies in cybernetics that Hales discusses.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting in connection with the sort of later waves that she's talking about in connection with autopoiesis and so on, where, like, so the experiment, you know, taking this frog and, like, inserting electrodes into its brain and so on, like, she describes it as, like, taking this autopoietic system, that, you know, the frog is a living being that tries to, you know, persist in existence and, you know, continue to live, and turning it into an allopoietic system where, you know, it's, you know, a device, that, you know, the frog is turned into a device for producing marks that you can publish in a paper, essentially. And this reminded me of there's a little sort of throwaway line in Kant's Metaphysical Foundations of Natural Science, like in the introduction, I think, where he said, like, the reason why psychology can never be a science is because the subject would never submit to being the object of study. So, like, a subject, you know, a human being in the sort of normal sense, but any sort of rational being is a autonomous entity. It's an entity that can, you know, set its own goals for what it is trying to do in its existence and so on. And to take that, and, you know, for Kant, of course, the frog is not an autonomous being, but I think we can, you know, recognize a certain kind of autonomy to a frog in the sense that it's an entity that, you know, pursues its own goals in its existence and in keeping itself alive and so on. So, like, this autonomous being, whether it's a human subject or a frog or whatever, to turn it into, like, to make it into an object of study is to sort of eliminate its autonomy and turn it into something that is, like, heteronomous. So it's something that exists for the purpose, for my purposes, for the purpose of me being able to produce results that I can, you know, put into a scientific theory and publish and so on. This process of turning an autonomous being into an object of study seems to necessarily involve this kind of elimination of that autonomy. And so if you want to have a scientific account of autonomy as such, like, which is sort of one of the ambitions of this cybernetic project, you're kind of like, you have this sort of paradox where, like, the scientific investigative method that you're trying to apply to the subject is precisely what eliminates that autonomy of the subject that you're trying to account for. I'm not sure if there's, like, a way of sort of studying a subject scientifically that doesn't sort of eliminate that autonomy of the subject in that sense. This same kind of objection, I think, is going to come up in Ruyer as well, that he's going to talk about, like, how the machine as already constituted is not, it can't be used to explain the constitution of the machine in the first place. I think it's like sort of the general, like, one sentence or sort of slogan version of what Ruyer is going to object to cybernetics. And so I think that's just like a good sort of preview of what we're going to go through in the book.
Yeah, I liked that as a critique of behaviorism as well, that the behaviorist remains autopoietic while reducing the human subject under observation to an allopoietic object, as you were just describing.
Yeah, in this sense, I find it kind of interesting that even if we ended up maybe like not agreeing with this approach to the first wave of cybernetics, the way that we can retroactively look back upon it and see maybe the mistakes that we see they could have made, you know, in these philosophical ways. Well, there's a lot of value in that as well, right? Like, it's not always so clear to see such an issue appearing in a scientific program. And then I think it's interesting that it was the actual cyberneticians themselves, or, you know, the people in the Macy conferences that kept battling with these concepts, right? So yeah, I find it really neat that even if maybe I wouldn't really read one of the original papers with the enthusiasm of the project that they were trying to do, from the point of view of trying to learn out of the history of ideas, it seems really like worthwhile to take a look at cybernetics and what it was aiming to do and where it failed and so on.
Yeah, I think part of what makes cybernetics so fascinating is precisely, to trace the failure, I think, of it. Like in comparison or in contrast with, for example, behaviorism, which suffers from, I think, a lot of the same intellectual deficiencies, but is not especially interesting, in my opinion. The same kind of like oversimplification and like, you know, drive to generalize from these like extremely simplified models to like explain everything about human behavior. But the behaviorists, I think, were much more dogmatic in the sense that they, like, once they had figured out what behavior was, they like just assumed that everything, you know, like had to fit this model of behavior and anything else was just like nonsense. Right. And there is some of that, tendency, I guess, in some of the cybernetics people, but there's also like this sort of pushback or like this friction, I guess, in their like in the operation of these models that they're working with, where they like keep running into these problems of like reflexivity that Hales talks about, and the supposed subjective stuff that they're trying to get rid of keeps like reappearing, the sort of return of the repressed, and so following this development, I think, is very interesting, and it's a kind of failure that is actually valuable in the sense that, in a way that the failure of behaviorism is not that valuable, I think, except to say, like, this is not something that we want to, you know, try again. Following some of the failures of cybernetics is actually interesting and allows you to learn, I think, about the nature of behavior and cognition and all these things, through figuring out why these attempts to explain it didn't work.
Yeah, Hales seems, was for most of the essay, was pretty critical about drawing this, the effects of this analogy between the human and the machine, even when it was disavowed, because it was still kind of operating as disavowed. That point she made about how you can say that a chicken is not like a tractor, but you will still be comparing a chicken and a tractor and saying how they're not alike. But then at the end, her tone kind of changed and she seemed much more optimistic about another way of thinking about humanity in light relation to machines. And, there is this, we do have this, I don't know if I, I mean, I don't know if I would call it like a necessary relation, but this relation to exteriorization and technics, which because of the development of technology may, you know, allow for, I don't know, different expressions of humanity, or maybe Hales would say like post-humanity, in a way that actually kind of reminded me of that essay in volume 2 of Individuation where Simon Don talks about the engineer or the technician. I can't remember which phrase he used, but in that essay, the engineer, the technician was this figure who kind of relates to the outside of the social through the technical in a way that transforms the social, which I think is a similarly optimistic view of technology to the one Hales strikes at the end of this essay.
Yeah, I think like in maybe like the earlier part of this essay, when she's talking about sort of the methodology of what she's trying to do, she talks about how like the concepts that the cybernetics people were developing are always in relation to the artifacts that they're producing, like this electronic rat or the homeostat and so on. But of course, the like realization of your concept is never like a one-to-one copy of your concept. When you build this electronic rat, it does something not exactly... It doesn't do exactly what you expected it to do. It does things that you maybe didn't expect. And so you have to develop new concepts or modify your existing concepts. And then that leads you to produce a new artifact, which again affects your concepts and so on. So there's this like constant cycling between the like intellectual realm and the you know, artifacts that you're producing in relation to that intellectual realm. And there's never a complete harmony or like equivalence from one to the other. And so like, just the fact that you're like taking your ideas about how human behavior or animal behavior works, and then you're trying to build a machine that, you know, realizes or exhibits the same sort of structure, just by building that machine, you are already sort of like forced to go beyond your intellectual model of behavior, and that like sort of feeds back into your intellectual modeling and you know, forces you to transform it. And yeah, so I think like specifically the fact that these people were engineers, or a lot of them were engineers, and you know, building, you know, devices to produce these ideas or to exhibit these ideas, I think maybe is part of that what we were talking about, like that sort of why cybernetics is more interesting than behaviorism, for example, because you know, the behaviorists were not engineers in general. They were just like psychologists, you know, trying to get pigeons to press a button or whatever. You know, the fact that you can't like just sort of you know, write on paper that, you know, a human being, you know, writing a symphony is the same as a pigeon pressing a button, you have to actually build the symphony writing machine, and then you realize it's a lot harder than you maybe expected. Yeah, so this fact that they actually have to build a device and, you know, figure out how to make it work already sort of introduces that like I was saying, friction earlier, or like it introduces a certain like motive impulse, I guess, to their intellectual enterprise, where they can't just sort of stay like stuck in the like principles that they've posited at the outset and just sort of dogmatically stick to them. They have to like keep transforming those principles as they like try to justify them and like exhibit them and sort of present a device that you know, follows these principles. They end up having to transform those principles to do that.
I'm not sure if y'all that read Ponti could maybe thought this was nicer, but I felt the end and the stuff about virtual reality was kind of not so convincing. But there was a lot of talk about disembodiment and stuff, so maybe I'm missing some Ponti stuff.
Yeah, it's a good point. I think that part is a little bit quick in this paper, but I think it's interesting that like this notion of information was such a central concept to cybernetics and the, you know, development of this sort of intellectual sphere. And Simon Don talks about like the fact, you know, in the word information, there's already this, you know, etymologically, there's this notion of form, which of course you can, you know, trace back to Plato and so on. And this distinction between form and matter. And in certain ways, this notion of information that, you know, it develops in this very technical domain and you know, has these very technical purposes, is a sort of reproduction or recreation of this notion of form that you find in Plato, where, you know, the triangle as such is not this, you know, specific mark of ink on a piece of papyrus or, you know, traced in the sand or whatever, but it's this, you know, form that can be realized in many different media and incarnations. And likewise, you know, the information that you're transmitting the signal that there is a triangle, for example, it's not, you know, the fact, like, the same message can be transmitted either as, you know, electrical pulses through a wire or radio waves or whatever, if we're, you know, sticking with 1940s technology. So like this message, the information that you're conveying is likewise sort of abstracted from the material incarnation or realization of that message. It doesn't really matter from the perspective of the engineer whether you are using a cable or wireless transmission. The only relevance of that material realization is the extent to which it distorts or introduces noise into the signal. And again, so when you try to sort of extend this concept of information to like human life as such or human existence as such, then it sort of leads you to this like fantasy or this image of like the human body and embodiment in general as like, again, this sort of noise introduced into the operation of this information device that would be the human mind, or, you know, this sort of fantasy of, you know, uploading your consciousness into a computer that has, you know, fascinated science fiction writers and like these sort of quasi science fiction theorists who say that this is just like 10 years away that we're going to be able to do this, right? For the last 50 years. So this idea that like the human body is like just a sort of medium through which this information processing system operates, or just like, you know, the body is only relevant insofar as it introduces noise into the operation of this information processing system. I think it's like a sort of extreme consequence of this general conception of information as something that is abstracted from the medium that transmits the information. And it's still, you know, present today. It's still something, you know, I think like Elon Musk has talked about like this, you know, mind uploading thing and this idea that, you know, what if reality is actually just a simulation running on a computer and so on, like this, you know, the sort of fake deep, like first year philosophy discussion kind of thing. Like these ideas are still around today and still popular. And so like this conception that like what really matters is this abstract information that is not sort of materially that has no like need for material, that the material is just sort of like incidental to the information. I think this same conception is still around today and still very, very popular.
Yeah, that reminds me of functionalism, kind of instilled maybe through Dewey and stuff. But
yeah, and so like this whole like I think like so what she sort of emphasizes towards the end of the article is that, you know, even when you talk about these like virtual reality, you know, systems and like you hear like all the time in like sort of journalistic writing about the internet is presented as like something like ethereal and non-material, but of course the internet is only possible because there are these networks of, you know, thousands of kilometers of cables that run over the ocean floor, for example, to transmit signals from North America to Europe and vice versa, and, you know, around the world. That like there's this very and then you know you have servers and data centers and so on that like there's a very material infrastructure that has to exist for this supposedly ethereal systems that, you know, are pure information and are virtual and have this sort of non-material interpretation in like sort of popular conception. And likewise for these virtual reality systems, you need to have a computer that is running this simulation process. You need to have like the goggles that present this virtual world to you and so on. All of this, needs to be realized in some sort of material device. So like yeah, this sort of immateriality is always produced in a material system of some kind. And yeah, so the internet is just as material as, you know, the slide rules that people were using in the 1930s, or like these mechanical calculators and so on. The internet is not like more abstract in the sense of like just pure information, as opposed to whatever you know, mechanical calculators were being used in the 1930s.
I don't remember from reading Neuromancer whether he talks about cybernetics. I mean, I know he talks about like the cyber a lot, but I wasn't sure if he if William Gibson actually refers to cybernetics in that book. But if that is something else that cybernetics gave us, then another point for it being an interesting failure in a way that behaviorism was not.
Yeah, and there's an interesting bit in Neuromancer where, like, so they have this like idea of, you know, uploading your consciousness to some sort of computer system that you know, like there's a one of these like hacker people is like uploaded to a computer, and you know, after his death, this recording of him is still around, and he sort of this sort of reproduced version of the of this person, like his demand for like his services is that he be deleted afterwards, because he doesn't want to exist as this sort of reproduced person anymore.
I remember that character.
The mentor figure. Yeah. So like in this, like even so in this novel, like the disembodied consciousness condition, like being this disembodied consciousness is presented as like something is a kind of torture, or like, I don't know, a kind of like spiritual torture, I guess. Like he compares it to like the phantom limb phenomenon, where like, you know, someone who has had an amputation of a, you know, a hand or a leg or whatever, often people who have this experience, they feel like a pain or something in that limb that is missing, and it's actually extremely painful, or like it causes a lot of suffering to these people, because you can't do anything about this limb that doesn't exist, that it's like in pain. Like, you know, you feel an itch in your missing hand, you can't scratch that hand. And so this, you know, this disembodied consciousness character says like his whole existence is like this phantom limb sensation, and he wants to put an end to it. So like there's, I mean, obviously this novel is not like a intellectual text about embodiment or the nature of the human mind or whatever, but it sort of presents this condition of being a disembodied consciousness that, you know, is often presented as like the sort of liberation from the material realm and, you know, freeing us from the constraints of the body, but it presents it as like this kind of torture and something that is actually not desirable in I think a pretty interesting way.
Well, what's that just reminded me of is the disembodied mind can't be static. Because I believe nowadays, if, say, somebody's lost a limb and they have some phantom pain, they can do some tricks with mirrors to try to alleviate that pain. Maybe if their disembodied hand is in a fist and they can't stop squeezing, they're able to do some interesting things. So that must be some sort of dynamic model.
Yes, yeah. There's that, I forget his name, but there's a neuroscientist who, or he might be a clinical neurologist who had sort of develop this technique. But yeah, so like someone has had their right hand amputated, for example, and they have this sort of phantom limb sensation of like their right hand is like clenched into a fist, like a really tight fist, and it's extremely painful, but they can't unclench their hand because they don't have that hand. And what this scientist or clinician had developed was to take the person's left hand and put a mirror so that, I think that might be his name, Ramachandran. So you put the mirror facing the left hand, the remaining hand, and you have the person make a fist with their remaining hand and then unclench it. And then as they're doing that, they watch the mirror hand, which looks like a right hand, which, you know, looks like their right hand. And so they watch their, you know, mirror right hand unclench. And that apparently actually allows them to, you know, alleviate that sensation of having that missing right hand clenched all the time, and they actually experience relief of that feeling. So like part of what is interesting about these sort of virtual reality experiments and devices and so on, is that it turns out that our sort of experience of embodiment is pretty malleable. So it's not like we have like sort of a built-in like program for what our body looks like. You know, you could picture, like, if you're designing a robot, for example, in a sort of a humanoid robot, you might like build into the robot a model that, like, you know, here are your two arms, here are your two legs, you know, this is how they move and so on. But it doesn't seem like the human capacity to like move our bodies and so on is like that. It seems like we actually are pretty capable of, you know, learning what our body looks like, you know, how it's built, what, you know, how it moves and so on. And we can actually, like, within a few minutes even, like, learn a completely different, you know, orientation of like, you know, how the body operates, and, you know, what our embodiment consists in. So Angus has put in the chat here the point that Merleau-Ponty makes about, like, how the blind person who uses a cane to navigate the world, that, like, that person doesn't, you know, experience sensations in their hand of, like, the cane pressure on their hand. What they experience is, like, there's an obstacle in front of me that I'm touching with the cane. And you can think of the same thing, like, driving a car or riding a bicycle. You experience the texture of the road. You don't experience vibrations in your hands, even though, of course, your experience of the road is mediated through the vibration of the vehicle that is, you know, applying pressure to your hands. But, like, your actual experience is of the road. And so, like, your sort of body schema is in some sense, like, extended into the vehicle that is mediating your connection with the road surface. And obviously, like, you never, like, sort of confuse your body with the bicycle in like, you don't, like, feel pain if someone, you know, hits the bicycle, for example. There are other, like, more sort of direct virtual reality experiments. Like, there's one sort of famous set of experiments with a rubber hand, I think this one is not even using, like, a virtual reality apparatus in the sort of standard sense, but, like, you have someone looking at, like, a rubber hand on the table, you take, like, a feather or something, and you rub it back and forth on the rubber hand. And then you take the same type of feather or brush or whatever, and you rub it on the person's biological hand, which is out of their view, in the same rhythm as the rubber hand is being rubbed. So you have, you know, one brush or feather rubbing the rubber hand that the person is watching, and then another feather or brush rubbing the biological hand that is out of view. And as you are watching this rubber hand being rubbed with the feather or brush or whatever, you start to experience the sensation, the touch sensation, as if it's in the rubber hand. The spatial location of the sensation, like, you experience it as in the rubber hand, even though your biological hand is like in a different location. So in some of these experiments, they take, like, a hammer and go, like, they're about to strike the rubber hand, and the person sort of recoils their hand as if, like, it's their hand that's about to be hit with a hammer. When, of course, it's the rubber hand sitting on the desk that is, like, a meter away from their biological hand. So, like, even within the space of a few minutes, your, like, experience of what is part of your body can sort of be modified to, you know, transfer onto this rubber hand and this is obviously a very low-tech, like, the sort of connection between your hand, your biological hand, and this rubber hand is extremely basic. It's just this, you know, rhythmic brushing pattern. And you can imagine, like, if you have a more complex and subtle connection involving, you know, feedback and so on, that it would be even more effective at, like, displacing your experience of where the sensation is happening and what is part of your body. So this whole operation would be much more, you would have a much more profound sense of embodiment in that hand, as opposed to just, like, this rhythmic brushing pattern.
Slightly different, but I would like to bring up maybe just the word cybernetics. I think it's kind of interesting. Netics, of course, the study of, and cyber, I think, comes from the old Greek term kuber, which is literally just, like, control or the steering of a ship. So cybernetics to me is really just a study of control almost. But I guess that's just very, very general definition.
Yeah. And like the sort of original text from Norbert Wiener, the subtitle, so the title is Cybernetics and the subtitle is Control and Communication in Man and Machine, if I am not mistaken. Yeah, and so like this idea of control, of course, is presented in an extremely sort of technical sense, that like it's about, you know, you have a device that, you know, does something and you want to ensure that it does the thing under the conditions and in the way that you want it to. So like your ship, you want to steer in a certain direction, you turn the wheel and the, you know, this device moves the rudder so that the ship, you know, goes in the heading you want. So this is a sort of like basic idea of what this kind of control means. But then, of course, there's a political sense of control in terms of, you know, who is making decisions about where the ship is going, for example, or whether the ship is going to be built in the first place at all. That are, and these are sort of in the background, I think, in a lot of the cybernetics literature, and especially when you think about like this orientation towards homeostasis and this idea that like what is desirable is for things to stay the same. There's a pretty clear, you know, political direction to what this would mean if you tried to apply the same, you know, principle of homeostasis to a society, that like what is desirable about the control of a society is to ensure that it stays the same. And obviously there are other political ideas that other people might have about whether that is desirable or not.
I really like this Hales text. I think it was a great introduction.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I've actually read anything else from her, but I know I've like had her work on my radar for a long time. That's something that I want to read. And yeah, I was also really impressed by this text. I think it did a really good job of like presenting some of the like difficulties and you know, contradictions even of like what cybernetics was trying to do, but like without sort of just sort of dismissing the whole thing, like taking seriously what they were doing, without sort of like, you know, buying the whole package of ideas as well. So like, yeah, the difficulties and the interest of the whole enterprise are like conveyed in this text in a good way.
Yeah, I think you mentioned at the very beginning this approach that she took to the study of cybernetics, that it was kind of interesting. And I would agree. And I think one of the main strengths of it is that it yielded a very easy to understand analysis of the development of the different waves of cybernetics and how you could already see some, or, you know, the second wave kind of emerging from the tensions that were already present in the first one, and also like not breaking completely with the first one either, and so on, right? There's a like step-by-step process kind of, or you get the feeling that that's sort of what was going on. You have that diagram that was posted above, that she uses, and yeah, I think for me that was actually an interesting thing to keep in mind, where the, as I understood it at least, the different widths of the constellations signify the strength of certain ideas at a specific period, and you can kind of see that there is a, even though it's sort of done in a kind of vague wave, or, you know, it's a very simplified diagram, but you can, it gets the point across that these things were oftentimes, or the difference between the first and second waves were oftentimes like difference between the importance given to certain ideas versus the, and the acceptance maybe of those ideas. But it's not like they popped out of nowhere, right? Yeah, exactly. The one that Jack posted.
Yeah, I saw, can't remember who it was, but someone was posting like some discussion earlier about like, you know, how does this compare to, like, so early in the text, she sort of contrasts her, I guess, model of, you know, the development of cybernetics in these three waves to like the Kuhn model of a change of paradigm, and Foucault's notion of episteme that changes. And so she present what she presents as being like the difference is that these different ways of cybernetics involve a kind of a certain amount of continuity, even though of course there's change from one wave to the next, but each wave is sort of like taking elements from the previous one. Like, so there's these constellations, these like sort of connections of different ideas that, you know, into like something that they take to be coherent or to be like a single package. And that constellation is sort of dismantled and then reassembled into a new constellation with maybe new things added and some elements dropped and so on. You know, so each wave is like, is not just sort of something radically new, but it involves, taking an existing constellation and dismantling it and building a new constellation using some of those parts. I mean, I think it might be like she just sort of presents us in like one sentence as this contrast between the Kuhn / Foucault model and her model. It would be interesting to look at, you know, to what extent that's like a fair depiction of the contrast between these two approaches to like intellectual history, intellectual development. I think with Kuhn, for example, there's this depiction of the paradigm shift as a kind of Gestalt switch, I think is the term that he uses sometimes. So there's like some arrangement, like you do an experiment and you understand the result in a certain way because it fits your like theoretical conception or your paradigm that you're operating with. At some point, you know, the same experiment gets interpreted in a different way. So like one of his examples is like the experiments that produce dephlogisticated air in one intellectual context, and then in a different context, they're understood as producing oxygen. So it's not that something has changed about the experimental setup, it's that the understanding of what is going on has changed and it's a different paradigm. And so he describes this as a kind of Gestalt switch, where like, you know, you can think of these like ambiguous images, like the cube that you can view as either from above or from below. But I think that sort of image of what is involved in a paradigm shift also suggests that it does retain something from the previous paradigm. So like when you view the cube either from above or below, the lines on the paper are still the same either way. So it's not as if the original cube is like completely destroyed and there's like some new image that is presented to you after the Gestalt switch. So likewise, in the case of the dephlogisticated air experiment, the apparatus that you're producing and whatever the, you know, gas that comes out of this apparatus, you know, this whole setup is the same, you know, before and after the concept of oxygen is introduced. Again, it's not quite as straightforward to say that there's like a complete break from one to the next in the way that maybe she is suggesting here.
Okay, yeah, I think that makes more sense than what I was thinking. Like we were posting in the chat, I really like that idea of a skeuomorph, that thing that's just like kind of a holdover from the previous built into the new. That was definitely a cool idea. And is this kind of what you were talking about, earlier when you were saying you like this kind of method to explore the history? Is this kind of what she called archaeological anthropology?
Yeah, I think like, so yeah, it's, I mean, Foucault also uses the term archaeology, but I think maybe in a different sense, but it's this idea that like you take some like, I don't know, intellectual grouping that lasts for a certain amount of time, like the cybernetics grouping, and you sort of decompose it into like, what are the different elements that are like sort of feeding into this, or that are involved, or that are at play in this intellectual grouping? And then you trace like how do those elements get arranged in at one point of the development, or you know, in one like sub grouping of this grouping? Like, how are they used? And then how do those elements get rearranged and repurposed in a different form or a different stage of the development of this intellectual grouping? And I think it would be interesting to try to apply this to like history of philosophy, for example, where you have similar, intellectual groupings where people will like take an idea, like you can think of maybe like German idealism, for example, where Kant is presenting certain concepts and uses a certain terminology. And then people like Fichte are like taking up that terminology and doing something quite different with it. For many years, Fichte is insisting that, oh, I'm just doing, I'm just presenting Kant's philosophy. I'm not doing something different. I'm not doing something of my own. And then Kant, of course, you know, denies that. He says that, you know, this is actually something different than what I was trying to do. So, like, you know, tracing how that idea sort of like how these intellectual constellations get like decomposed and, you know, dismantled and then reassembled into a new constellation, sometimes even without the people involved actually realizing that they have done this. I think that would be an interesting method to apply to, yeah, history of philosophy or any other domain of intellectual history.
Yeah, I agree. I'm actually reading like the intellectual history of American philosophy, so I'm going to try to kind of diagram it in this fashion or attempt to. And then one weird question maybe is there any reason as to why there's so much French cyberneticians and American cyberneticians? And I think, like Bat said, we got a bunch of Latino cyberneticians as well, but it's kind of, I guess maybe it's just worldly, because then you could maybe say Russia had cybernetics as well.
Yeah, there was. So I think in the early years when cybernetics was first introduced, the Soviets, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was opposed to the idea of cybernetics and, you know, criticized as like a bourgeois ideology and so on. But then by like the, I think maybe like the late 60s, there was like more openness to cybernetics as like something that could be adopted for the purposes of managing a planned economy, for example. And so there was like a Soviet cybernetics school or tradition or whatever, but I don't know really anything about it beyond that. But like, you know, what use they made of the cybernetic concepts, how they understood them and so on. I don't think that's going to come up at all in the Huillet book. I think that's probably before, I think his book is written before that sort of adoption of cybernetics in the Soviet Union happened. But it's something I would like to learn more about. But yeah, like obviously the sort of home base of cybernetics was the US. Like that's where the Macy conferences were held, and where a lot of the sort of people that developed these ideas were based. But we were also talking like just over on Discord, like over the last week or so, about how it's interesting that Norbert Wiener did a lot of his research that sort of goes into the book Cybernetics in Mexico. He talks about like, you know, working with a physiologist in Mexico and like taking some of these ideas from like, you know, basically engineering problems and like trying to see like, is there a physiological problem that is similar to this in some sense? And so a lot of that work happened in Mexico. And then you have Chile, of course, with Varela and Maturana. There are like a few, and then there's Stafford Beer as well in the UK, who also ended up going to Chile and working on their like weird like cybernetic control room system that we didn't end up talking about, but Project Cybersign was this like project under Allende that would was supposed to be like a sort of cybernetic inspired way of managing the economy. So Stafford Beer was from the UK and traveled to Chile to help set up this system. There are a few like other people in other parts of the world that like make use of cybernetics and contribute to the like cybernetic enterprise. But yeah, the US is definitely the center of this whole intellectual world.
I'm very much looking forward to reading the Ruyer text. I know he has another text that I really want to read, but it's not been translated yet. It's called The Gnosis of Princeton. That one sounds very interesting as well.
Oh yeah, so that's the one where he like invents a fake like Gnostic sect that he like presents as if this is like a society that exists at Princeton, but it doesn't. I haven't read that one. I don't know like why he does this very strange like sort of fictional Gnostic operation, but I would like to read that at some point and try to understand what was the purpose of this very strange enterprise.
Apparently people thought it was real too. Like I think that he was relatively unknown before Gnosis of Princeton, and then at least initially people were tricked by it, which is, I guess, kind of a funny self-marketing scheme.
it's kind of like the Foucault pendulum effect. Like, I don't know if anyone's read that Umberto Eco book, where like these people invent like a fake sort of like, you know, Knights Templar, you know, Freemasons, sort of like occult conspiracy theory, and then like a bunch of people believe that it actually like is a real thing and start like being like trying to track them down and so on. Anyway, so it's the same thing here, I guess, where like he invents this like fake sect, and then other people are convinced that it's a real thing.
Must be a French thing.
For the I guess we're not meeting next week, but for the meeting after that, are we going to skip the introduction and go straight into the text itself?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So there's a translator's introduction. I would suggest skipping that, and maybe we can like come back to it at the end if we are interested. But yeah, I would suggest just going right into the portion of the text that is actually written by Rouillet.
Okay. Sounds good.
There's also, I have the French copy here in front of me. In this edition, there's like an extra chapter added in 1967. I didn't check if the English translation also has it. Yes, it does. Okay. Yeah. So when we get to that, we can read that as well. But yeah, so just like keeping in mind that was added in 1967, as opposed to the original publication of the text in 1954.
Is that just chapter 10?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, okay. So the problem of cybernetics in 1964. So the original text from 1954 ends with what is listed as chapter 9, so summary and conclusion. And then in 1967, he adds a new chapter, which is quite long, 40 pages in the translation. But yeah, so getting like where things stand in 1967 compared to where they stood in 1954.
Oh, cool.
Okay, so yeah, I think we can wrap up here unless anyone has any like final remarks or anything like that. Okay. Yeah, sounds like that's a no. Okay, so yeah, so like I said, we're not going to be meeting next week, but the week after we will start into the Rouillet text itself, and we will go back to our, you know, regular reading style where we read a page and then discuss. So anyone who's like following along, you don't need to read ahead. Of course you can if you want to, but yeah, we'll be reading through it in a linear order as opposed to the more complicated feedback loops that we went through today.
Sounds good.
Cool. Okay, so thank you everyone. That was a interesting discussion, lots of good points, and yeah, so hope to see you in 2 weeks when we pick up on the book itself.